My name is Mitch Wertlieb, and I'm the Morning Edition host at Vermont Public Radio. Thank you so much for coming out on a chilly Thursday evening. I really appreciate it. While I'm comfortable behind a microphone, I'm used to doing it in our beautiful VPR studios where nobody can see me. But you can all see me, so that's making me a tad bit nervous. But I think our panelists here are going to make me less nervous as we talk about the topic we're all here about tonight, sports and injuries and the passion to play sports. And we just got a great group of people here. And the first person I'll introduce is Aaron Quinn. Aaron, if you could stand up, please. Director of Athletics, Middlebury College. He's in his 10th year in that position with 24 years total at Middlebury under his belt. And a pretty good record to boast under that tenure as well, a record of 9 straight top 5 finishes in the Learfield Sports Director's Cup standings, plus the Director's Cup title, Middlebury's first, in 2012. Sean Farrell is with us tonight as well. Sean is Athletics and Activities Director at Middlebury Union High School, and he's been serving in that capacity since 2003. Sean Farrell also represents Middlebury Union High School at the Vermont Principals Association as chair of the football, hockey, and dance committees, and is also vice president of the Vermont State Athletic Directors Association. Sean, thank you for being here so much. Wendy Leeds is with us tonight. She is the varsity girls soccer coach at Middlebury Union High School, and she has promised not to make Kelsey Smith do any wind sprints tonight, which is very nice of her. Kelsey is the captain of the girls soccer team at Middlebury Union High School. And a special thank you to Kelsey for being here tonight because she just had a game tonight that she came from. They won, by the way, 3-1. Is that right, Kelsey? Okay. There you go. Straight from the game here. Thank you so much for being here, Kelsey. Dr. Matt Gammons is with us this evening, sports medicine physician at the Vermont Orthopedic Clinic and also the director of the Sports Concussion Clinic. In addition, Dr. Gammons is vice president of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine and has served as team physician for the U.S. ski and snowboarding team with affiliations with a number of area colleges, universities, and high schools, including, but not limited to, Castleton University, Green Mountain College, and Rutland High School. Dr. Gammons, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Last but not least, John and Sheila Stawinski are here, the co-owners of Fit2XL. That's a facility in Essex Junction that provides services from group fitness to athletic performance training and injury rehabilitation to neurocognitive concussion testing. John Stawinski is a certified athletic trainer and strength and conditioning coach. Sheila Stawinski has a background in sports psychology as well as serving as the leadership director to varsity sports captains at 3 area high schools. And I also want to thank the folks of the Town Hall Theater in Middlebury tonight. What a wonderful building this is. It's beautiful, my first time here. It's beautiful outside, it's intimate and warm inside. And most of all, thank you folks for showing up tonight. It's just so great to have you here. And I hope we're in for a lively and informative discussion tonight. The reason that I wanted to do this is because I've been a sports fan all my life. I played sports in high school. I still pretend that I play sports. I play in a recreational floor hockey league. It's not good for my arthritis, which I have in my hip, but I don't care. I get out there and play anyway. And so I thought, if I'm that passionate about sports, what about people who, you know, play it all the time, athletes like Kelsey, coaches like Wendy Leeds, the folks who take care of these athletes when they get hurt, the doctors who have to look at serious things like concussions, and what are the risks involved? What does it mean to get out there on the field sometimes when, you know, maybe you shouldn't be? What does it mean to be that dedicated to a sport that you are willing to risk serious injury to get out there and play and do the thing that you love? And that's kind of why we're all here tonight. I'm sure that many of you are parents that are concerned about your kids perhaps playing sports, the kind of sports they may want to play, or maybe you just have an interest in this topic and want to hear your voice heard. What we're going to do during the evening is Ty Robertson, stand up, Ty, thank you very much. She's got a pad and pens. We're going to do this old school, and if you have a question that you would like me to ask the panel, just wave your hand to Ty, let her know that you're out there, and she will come by. You can write it down, and she'll bring it up to me, and we'll go ahead and ask the panel. And I've got plenty of questions to ask them as well. And we'll talk about anything you want to talk about. I know that concussions are a big topic. Certainly the sport of football is a big topic, but concussions are certainly not limited to that sport, as we'll be hearing about shortly. So there's a lot to get to tonight, and I hope that we can go ahead and do that. What I want to start with is, before I do start, I should say, can you turn off your cell phones and all that kind of stuff? It's like a movie theater, all that. I turned off mine, so I won't embarrass myself by having it ring after telling you to please turn yours off. One of the things I noted in researching this topic was that the National Academy of Sciences in 2009 did a study and found that more than 250,000 youth athletes suffered concussions that year. High school athletes are even more likely to suffer concussions than their older counterparts. The average high school player is nearly twice as likely to suffer a brain injury as a college player is, and the findings showed, the most recent ones, that college football players suffer concussions at a rate of 6.3 concussions per 10,000 athletic exposures. Now, each exposure represents a practice or a game. For high school football players, that comparable figure is 11.2. The study suggests that one of the primary problems in youth sports is that athletes, parents, and coaches don't have proper education about how to report and deal with concussions. And we certainly hope that that's changing, and I think that's one of the things that our experts, our panel, can talk to tonight. So I want to start with a question that was given to me before we got this going, and this comes from Jack Mayer, who is in attendance tonight. And he says, I'm a pediatrician in Middlebury. I care for many children with concussions, most from football games and practice. Newton's first law states that a body in motion tends to stay in motion unless an external force is applied to it. Football is the only organized sport in which there are frequent repetitive hard collisions between players. The brain is shaken in the rigid cranium. That causes a certain amount of swelling and damage, and concussions are just the tip of the injury iceberg. We know that repetitive brain injury compounds the damage over a long period of time. It causes chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I think I'm saying that correctly. That's a degenerative neurological disease and with serious cognitive deficits. Now, given the abundance of evidence of permanent harm, Jack asks, should we not consider football as it is currently played as a suitable sport for young people? So I'm going to put that question first to Aaron. What about that? As an athletic director at Middlebury College, football is a sport that's played. How risky is this sport? Should this sport be played under these conditions, knowing what we know and are finding out more about concussions?
Yeah, thank you. I'm gonna answer that, but I'm gonna start. The question was asked: should it be played by young people? So I'm gonna start much younger, really briefly, and then jump ahead, because I think it's the number of hits over somebody's career over the course of a year. You know, that sort of accumulated impact is something that we're really interested in. And Sean and I, starting at the other end of the spectrum from college, probably, I guess about 10 or 12 years or so ago, took over with a number of people in town the youth football league, and reaffirmed a lot of our practices around being flag football, stressing safety first, and really trying to emphasize a youth football culture that was around safety and health first, and really trying to build the numbers up in town and have it promoted as a safe sport. And our first couple groups that went through were the couple of teams at the high school who've had such success the last couple of years. The numbers were a lot stronger. And we've seen, I think, because of making sure that we're educating coaches, bringing some of the professional knowledge from the college football coach, myself, Sean Farrell, the high school football coach, into the youth programs and making sure that we're safe from the youngest ages up, I think that's really important. And I'm not sure that that happens in every community. Jumping, skipping over a number of age groups and going to college, I think one of the things that we're fortunate at our level, at the collegiate level, is professional medical oversight and a lot of consultation with our professional staff, our college and team physician. It has several years ago helped found at the conference level a medical aspect and sport committee. And quite frankly, it was actually much more than concussions. There are issues on disordered eating at the collegiate level, MRSA, any number of health concerns, concussions clearly being a number one concern. And they track all the numbers throughout the league. It's a committee made up of physicians, athletic trainers, coaches, professors, deans. I believe that's it. Just to track these numbers and make sure that things are not in alarming numbers. And I think one of the things that happened in one of those first years is The Ivy League had done a big study and spent a lot of money and spent a lot of time to come up with a report to make some recommendations based on football in particular. Those recommendations got to our presidents, and when they presented them to the athletic directors and the medical aspect and sports committee, we were already much more conservative in NESCAC football going back 30, 40 years than these recommendations were. We have 8 football games. We have a late preseason. We don't go to postseason. We don't have spring football. And then some of the limitations or recommendations, best practices about what happens within a practice or within a season, I think virtually all, most if not all the teams were already following. So really important issues. I don't think the evidence has told our medical aspect and sports committee, our physician, or myself that this is a sport that we should be dropping at this point. I think we're taking the appropriate actions. Most of the experts that we're hearing are talking about limiting contact, and that's what we've been doing actually for many years and continue to do now.
Sean Farrell, what about what you're hearing from parents? Middlebury Union High School, I assume, plays football?
Yes.
Yeah. What I am sure they do. What do parents say about that? Is there any concern over what you're hearing about concussions?
I think with any athlete, you know, football aside, the parents, there's always a concern about injuries that can happen during a season. I think that the step that we've taken, and it's actually been supported by the Vermont Principals Association, is using the heads-up football model, which is really changing the terminology for our kids. And it's not so much that it's fundamentally changed how we do what we do, but it's the language. And it's everything is about, when I grew up, when we played football, it was always get your head across the body, put your head on the ball. All that language is taken out. Mm-hmm. And the only time they ever mention the head is it's heads up. The fundamentals of the actions that we're doing are pretty much the same, but it's that mental cue for the kids to say, keeping the head up, keeping the head up. And, you know, as Aaron said, we're trying to trickle that down to the youth level or our flag program, where it is padded full contact flag football, but we're training our coaches. They have the same concussion training that the officials have or the high school coaches have to have as a way to make sure that we're doing it the right way. You know, I think that as this heads-up football grows and the parents have a greater understanding of what we're doing and we're educating more coaches throughout the state, the hope is that the concussions will be reduced because the head is not going to be part of the game, and that the comfort level with letting their sons and daughters play will be there.
Dr. Gammons, I want to follow up with you on this. We were talking before this started. You wanted to dispel some myths about concussions, about the things that are heard out there. I don't think football is going away in this country anytime soon. You know, President Obama made comments about not wanting, if he had had a son, to have him play football. That perception is out there, that this is a dangerous sport, that concussions are serious business. What would you like to say about the myths about concussions, either erring on the side of caution or taking it a little too far and making it too much of a problem?
Well, I think as we were talking earlier, and with all due respect to Dr. Mayer's question, there are way more questions than answers. And the groups that, particularly the group at Boston University, that have looked at what's commonly called CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is a small group, and it's a small group of individuals, and the rest of the world is really questioning their research. And not because they don't think this entity exists, per se, but the breadth in which they're saying it exists. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but namely, if, you know, unfortunately, again, ESPN and the NFL and a lot of things get put on TV, but if you look, you know, over the last basically 50 years of the NFL, you know, people think, oh my gosh, this person killed himself. It had to be because he played football. But actually, suicide rates in the NFL are actually lower in former players than they are in the general population. And when you correct for chronic pain, which is what a lot of players have because they got bad knees and shoulders and things, depression rates are the same. So as a global community of athletes that have played in the NFL, they're not globally having problems. Now, are individuals having problems? There's no question that they are, but there's individuals that have problems all over. And so what we're really trying to figure out is, what is this actual entity? What are the actual markers? And then what can we do about it? yes, there's probably something to, and Dr. Cantu is sort of one of the most famous neurosurgeons down in Boston, who talks about maybe the youth athletes not hitting. And the truth of the matter is that probably at the young ages, you know, sort of that semi-contact and teaching them good techniques is more important. But because most kids that play in middle school or youth don't play middle school, most kids that play middle school don't play high school, most kids that play high school don't play college, and almost nobody who plays in college plays in the NFL. So there's a natural self-selection, you know, that I'm not going to have this lifetime of pounding to my head that potentially may cause problems. And in the end, it's the individual concussion. You know, when we always talk about, they say on ESPN, the NFL is a concussion problem. NFL doesn't have a concussion problem. NFL has a repetitive impact problem. And there's a difference with that. And if you think about essentially water dripping on a rock over time, water will wear a hole in a rock. I mean, it's, you know, low-level force can cause damage. If once in a while you get a force that's greater than that, okay, that adds to the totality. But that's one little blip in the big summation of the forces. So if you've got the wrong genetics and you hit your head too much, and maybe you did some things that you shouldn't have done, like anabolic steroids, or you drink too much, or other things that can affect your brain, you might have a problem. But for the majority of young athletes, if we educate them, if we recognize that there's been an injury, and we get them recovered from that injury, almost nobody's going to have a problem.
Wendy Leeds, you're the coach of the girls' varsity soccer team. What do you worry most about as a coach when it comes to injuries for your players? And I know that we'll be hearing from Kelsey, and she's got a story to tell about concussions, but there must be other injuries you'll deal with. And what are the protocols like? Do you know definitively when or when not you should put a player back on the field?
Yeah. Well, so as Sean mentioned, the coaches all do have to go through the concussion training. So we come in with a little bit of knowledge, but really the athletic trainer that's on staff helps make all those decisions in terms of assessing, diagnosing, that kind of thing. But certainly, you know, any injury is of concern, and you play competitive sports, you're putting yourself sort of at risk for that. I hope that part of my job is to help the girls figure out how to be competitive but keep themselves safe at the same time. There are ways that you can play a contact sport like soccer and minimize the risk in terms of, you know, how you make a tackle, that kind of thing. And we talk about that, hopefully. And then as far as when those injuries unfortunately do happen, and they do happen, we have, like I said, we have the athletic trainer on staff to help with that. The return to play protocol takes the guesswork out of that for me as a coach. I really leave it to the athletic trainer to kind of guide the player through that process of coming back to where it's safe for her to come back in and play. And, you know, it's going to happen, so you have to plan for it. And, you know, that's part of why you have a roster of 20 or 22 or 23. So you have sort of that wiggle room in terms of giving people adequate time to heal and be ready to come back.
Kelsey, I know that maybe a lot of people don't think of soccer as, you know, the kind of sport that produces concussions. But you were telling me before we started here that you've been through this not once but twice. Why don't you tell us what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. My sophomore year, it was the end of a game, our regular season game against Virgins, and I slipped and fell and hit my head. It was a pretty wet game, sheets of rain coming down, and I just lost my footing. And for the week after that, I was at home on the couch, not necessarily because any doctors made me, but because I really just didn't feel that awesome. And so I stayed home, and then I came back to school the following week, and I was out for the rest of the season in terms of soccer. And it took about a month and a half, 2 months to get on my feet with schoolwork. But there were no long-lasting symptoms or anything with that. But my spring, that upcoming year, I got hit in a game again. And we unfortunately did not diagnose it as a concussion immediately. And I went about 2 weeks without any proper treatment or proper discussion about it. And that prolonged my injury for a pretty long time. So I was out for almost all of my spring season, which was pretty devastating. I play year-round, and it becomes a lifestyle. And I went to see Dr. Gammons. I talked to our athletic trainer, and they helped me get back on my feet. The schools nowadays are very good at least mine is, in terms of the return to school process, which is also incredibly important. I'm pretty confident about getting on the field when I'm injured. I have a lot of support behind me in terms of when I know I'm ready to go play, and I've been through it enough times that I am comfortable with knowing my body and when it's a good time to push and when it's a good time to hold back. But the return to school process is just as important. And I've had a lot of help from teachers and guidance counselors, making sure that I stay on my feet and keep my academics where I want them.
What were some of the symptoms like when you were in the worst parts of that concussion period? I mean, what were you feeling at the time?
A lot of the times, I just didn't feel like myself. And Sarah Johnstone, she is our athletic trainer, and she would explain that that's sometimes one of the biggest symptoms, that the player or the athlete just doesn't necessarily feel like themselves. And so I had headaches for a lot of time. I was nauseous, kind of dizzy, and then I would go back to school and the lights were pretty awful. So I'd have to go sit in the nurse's office, lay down, cover my eyes, not listen to really loud music or anything. And when they say that you have a concussion and you should go home and stare at the wall, that's kind of what they mean. And whether I liked it or not, that was what I did for a week on my first concussion. And that was definitely the right choice because I wasn't feeling super awesome. I wasn't feeling great. I had headaches and dizziness. And again, I really didn't feel like myself. And it took about a month for me to get back to my outgoing sort of chipper personality.
The first time you stepped back on the field, though, after that, what were your feelings then? Were you nervous about getting on the field that first time back when you were finally cleared to play?
Absolutely. I think after a month of not being on the field, I was more than ready to get out there and get some touches on the ball. But I knew the importance of it at that point, and getting out there, I was nervous. It was scary. You don't want to take any headers, and I made some executive decisions on, hey, I'm not going to win that ball, and my brain is not worth saving that goal. And that has been one of the hardest parts for me, I think, going through high school and club soccer and learning sort of how much is worth it, and stepping out on that field the first time after an injury is always that first testing the waters period of figuring out, okay, is this how hard I should be pushing, or should I take a step back and maybe take a little bit more time off? And so the nervousness, but also the excitement. I mean, I love to play soccer, and I love to be out there and moving, and I think that getting back into the sport is the most fun part of the recovery. That first day stepping on the field is the best.
John and Sheila Stawinski, I want to bring you into the conversation now. And Sheila, you do have a background in sports psychology. How much of Kelsey's story resonates with you? Do you hear a lot of this? I mean, you must be dealing with a lot of kids who get nervous about getting on the field after an injury.
I do. And Kelsey really laid the fieldwork very well for me in terms of kind of what I deal with. You know, she identified how hard it was and used the word devastated. That second concussion, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You couldn't play.
Absolutely.
And so I think there's a few levels of challenges here. The biggest challenge for any injured athlete is the identity that they have wrapped around their sport, right? It's really, for a lot of us and for a lot of you guys out here, it's who they are. It's before their biological name, they're the athlete, they're the player. So I deal with a lot of the psychology behind that, just helping them try to set goals, re-identify, encourage them to really understand that they still are that athlete, but they're just sidelined temporarily, and that alone is very difficult for any athlete to comprehend, to digest, to absorb, that it's really, this is a part-time job for them being hurt, not their future. But what I hear of Kelsey, which I think is very neat, personality factors have a lot to do with how they recover and how they perceive cognitively what's happened to me. Social support is hugely important. Parents, coaches, medical providers, community, schools, athletic directors, that is vital to an injured athlete's ability to cope, respond, and get better. I think she's a very bright young lady, and I think knowing that I have to stop and knowing that she needs to listen to her provider is very, very important. And the relationship between the athletic trainer and any physician and the injured athlete is a very pivotal relationship. Do they trust them? Do they believe them? Are they really on their side? Do they really care? Hugely important to growth and progressing forward out of that injury mentally. My job is always to emotionally help them cope in a way that once they return, there's not a lot of fear of re-injury. It's there. There's a lot of research written down about the fear of re-injury and how that predisposes one to becoming injured again. You know, and not with a concussion as much as maybe a knee injury or an ankle injury where you might brace on the field and be a little hesitant and thereby expose yourself to being injured again. So I do a lot of education and kind of panic mitigation work on training the athlete to just understand themselves in a new way. But it's a challenging process, and these kids are really devastated.
John Stawinski, talk a little bit about what you do at Fit2XL. The types of people you see, I mean, it's not just young people. You probably do see a lot of, though, high school, college athletes. What are most of the injuries that you see?
Sure. Well, we do see the whole gamut of ages, athletic abilities, experience, and everything's kind of thrown at us at one point or another, which is fantastic because it's nice to have that variety. What we really specialize in is more the younger or competitive athlete, I should say, the competitive athlete, because there's certainly people much older than me that are much more competitive and dedicated to whatever activity or sport that they're doing. But as far as injuries, that's a tough question. I was thinking about that. You know, it's they seem to come in clusters. Mm. You know, you get knees, you get shoulders, backs, concussions. Some of it you can say it's because of the season, like, you know, it's this sport going on or it's that sport. Because different sports, the nature is to injure different parts of their body. But really it comes down to working with that individual and understanding that individual. So if you're an athletic trainer at a high school, you have a lot of athletes, or at a college, you have a lot of athletes, college maybe a little bit less because you have some teams you're focused on, but it's important to understand that athlete, and you can't always do that yourself. You have to rely on the people around you, the coaches, teachers, parents, and we're fortunate that Sheila and I can work together, because if there is somebody who's having some struggles and they meet with Sheila, then we can communicate on those struggles, and I can apply what I've learned to their physical rehabilitation. And if it's a confidence issue, if they're afraid to get back, I can increase the reps. I can do things in a way that's going to build confidence in them before I put them in the situation where they get anxious about what they're doing. And just try and build confidence through reps, through showing them progress. I mean, it's athletes. Athletes want to go from 0 to 60, and if they're not at 60 in 2 weeks, things start to spiral down. So if I can show them, look, this is where you were when you started here, this is where you are now, this trajectory is going to put you probably back on the field at this point. I can't guarantee it, but and buy into that. Let's move in that direction. Let's build on this, and really my goal is to get you back on that field better than you were before you were injured. If I can do that, you're going to feel pretty good about being out there, and everybody else around you is going to, and it's going to be a smooth transition. So that's how we try and work together and deal with the physical and psychological pieces to athletic injury recovery.
I got this question via Twitter, and I'm going to ask first Dr. Gammons to speak to it, but then, you know, I have all you jump in here, because I love this question. I love the way it's worded. A woman named Carrie, who couldn't be here tonight, said, wanted to ask the panel, basically, I just want to keep my baby's 11 and 14-year-old brains safe without having them quit their passion. And I'm assuming that her babies, I love that she puts it that way, are talking about playing football, but it could be anything. It could be soccer. What would you say to Carrie here, who's obviously concerned? She hears the stories about concussions. She doesn't want her babies hurt, but they love playing sports. What's the general message to her?
I think that, and I should disclose here that my bias is that I make a living off of sports injuries and concussions, right? So maybe you have to take with what I say with a grain of salt. How much do I actually want to prevent them? I think, and we talk about this all the time, because I spend my life going to sports injury conferences. I was just in Burlington today talking at the UVM conference on sports injuries, and you're talking about all these things. And I constantly have to remind myself that kids get way more benefit from sport than they ever get harmed from sport. And yes, some kids get hurt, and as you guys may have seen in the news, there was a quarterback in New Jersey that died last week, unfortunately, ruptured his spleen. And it's tragic. I mean, it's absolutely tragic. But your kid's at much higher risk riding around with you in the car of having a catastrophic or bad thing than they are actually on the field, regardless of what field it is. When it comes to injuries, and these guys do a great job through the gamut of management, what we have to remember is that exposure trumps all. The amount that I expose myself to a particular risk, whether it be playing football or soccer or whatever, that trumps everything else we do by a factor of 1,000 when it comes to injury. So if I play 10 games versus 1 game, it's not that it's a factor of 10. It's actually probably even more than that. So when you talk about trying to prevent injuries and stay safe, you know, I think there's some common sense. There's some rule changes. There's good, you know, good teams and systems to keep kids safe. But, I mean, I have 2 girls, and I don't know, maybe one will want to play football. I don't know. But I certainly would not discourage her from playing football if she wanted to play, you know, or a sport that has a relatively high risk of concussion, because, you know, I think the benefits are much greater. And again, my other disclaimer, and maybe this is why I talk this way, is I had 7 concussions before I went to med school. And so most of those were playing soccer, some at UVM and some professionally, but a few were when I was younger. And, you know, I think for most people, whether it be an ACL injury or a bad shoulder injury or a knee injury, and it's the same reason when you talk to pro athletes that have been hurt, almost nobody says, I wouldn't do it again, because of that passion and what it's done for them. And just have to sit in a room and do nothing is often worse. And I think from your side, and you can speak to this, I mean, I spend more time sometimes dealing with the depression associated with the injury than I actually do dealing with the injury. So I think that's my real speech to that mom is, look, if they have a passion, then you should let them pursue it. Yes, we should try to make it as reasonably safe as we can, but we're not going to prevent everything. It can't happen. So
I think that's excellent. What I would add is, first of all, I think her instincts are exactly spot on, as they should be for a parent. And in my role, I have a little bit more distance from parents, and a lot is talked about parental involvement in sports, but also just child rearing in general, helicopter parents and lawnmower parents, et cetera. But when I meet with parents, I tell them, you know, stay away from commenting on playing time, stay away from commenting on the role of your son or daughter on the team, stay away from commenting on the X and O's of the sport. If you have any concerns about health or safety, pick up the phone and call me, and I will talk to you until you're satisfied. So what I would say to her is, like, when my son was going to play football and he was in second or third grade, whatever the next year was for football, I think he was in third grade, it was going to be fourth grade, I started going to all the youth football games in town and decided I didn't really love the way it was being run. A number of us got together and got involved with youth football to create a safer and healthier atmosphere. Not an overbearing parent atmosphere, but a safe and healthy atmosphere. So what I would encourage her to do is, Sean has much more intimate contact with parents, as Wendy does, coaching and being an administrator in the town where the kids are. But I would think that they would also welcome the conversations around health and safety. So being really involved and paying attention to the particular programs that her children are getting involved with, and making sure that she's comfortable with the safety of those programs is very appropriate, I would say.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I'd like to. I think Sheila had mentioned about the relationship between the athletic trainer and the athlete is, you know, trust is a big part of it. And I think that has to do with our coaches and our athletes as well. Is there's a bond and there's a trust there. And parents need to understand that the care that the coaches have for their athletes is paramount, and they want to make sure that they're safe. But the X factor here is we're dealing with teenagers who don't always listen and don't always do it the way we want to, that we instruct them to do it. And
this is shocking news, Sean.
Yeah. So shocked all of you. I don't know. So we're trying to create environments and teaching technique that is safe as possible, and yet sometimes they put themselves in harm's way by not necessarily using the technique that they were taught. Either it's competitive desire, it could be impulse, it could be desperation because they want to make the play. And I think, you know, honestly, that's where a lot of these injuries happen. I guess I'll speak specifically to football, is, you know, again, putting your head into the game as a last-ditch effort, and that's kind of where that can happen. And on the parent side, I think educate yourself as much as possible about the sport that your child is participating in, and so you have an understanding of what is a safe way of either technique or what the coaches are preaching to your son and daughter. If they come home and say, we're doing it this way, and you're like, well, all the research says don't, you know, that's where, you know, again, like Aaron said, you know, I don't want the phone calls about playing times, X's and O's either. But again, safety, you know, certainly I want to be aware of it, and I will act on it and work with our coaches to make sure that we're providing the safest environment as possible.
Can I make one comment? I'm sorry, because I think it's a great point with the education, but because we've done studies on the sort of the level of information that you can Google, right? I mean, Google, the almighty Google. I think, and this is what I tell patients, this is what I tell parents, the internet is a great place to gather information, to create questions, to then bring to your coach, or your athletic director, or your doctor, or your physical therapist. It is not a great place to generate opinions about definitives of what's going on. The only other comment I'll have, and this goes to parents as well, I always tell parents, the best thing you can do for your kid, and we have a saying, it's called stop the we. Which means if you're a parent and you ever refer to your child's team as we, then you got to take a step back and you got to take a deep breath and you understand that it's not we, it's them. And the number of parents that I sort of pull back from a conversation because they're more upset their kid's hurt than the kid is, it's unbelievable. And so I think that's sometimes the best thing you can do for your injured athlete is you got to pull yourself back a little bit and sort of just not hurt. I mean, as a parent, as my girls get hurt, it's the worst thing ever, right? It kills me that they get hurt. But, you know, getting hurt's okay sometimes, and you just got to step back a little bit, and it's part of the process.
I want to ask, I want to remind you folks, too, that I did get a question here, which I'm going to ask in a moment. But if you have questions for the panel, let Ty know, write them down, bring them up here, and we'll get them answered. Before I get to this, though, I want to ask Wendy Leeds, because I was struck by something that Kelsey said about when she did return to the field from her injury and mentioned that, you know, there was a moment where she knew she could have made a play. She could have gone up for a contested ball, chose not to, held back a little bit. I think that's the kind of thing I'm guessing here that you would certainly notice as a coach. Does part of you say, hey, you're the captain of the team here, you're supposed to be going for that ball? Does that thought ever cross your mind before maybe you say, oh, wait a second, that's Kelsey, she's had some concussions here?
Yeah, I benched her. She didn't see any more playing time after that decision. No. I mean, yes and no. I think that there's a difference between playing smart and playing scared. Mm-hmm. If I see a player who's playing scared, we need to talk about that. But I don't want them to get hurt either. And I, you know, if they're playing smart, then it's just an opportunity for us as a team to talk about that, what's happening out there and how do we want to play the game? How do we want to adjust our play?
Kelsey, what does Coach mean by that, playing scared? Is that something that you experienced when you came back?
Absolutely. I think playing scared was the single most important thing that I tried to avoid when stepping on the field. It's a mentality that when you step on the field, Mrs. Stawinski had mentioned before, that when you step on the field and you may have a tendency to get hurt more when you are not necessarily going in for a tackle correctly because you're scared to get hurt again. And I think that when I was a freshman, I was gunning to get on the field as soon as possible. And whether that meant sort of taking a few extra days that I could have waited and I went back too early, I now sort of focus on making sure that I am fully confident in my abilities when I step on the field, and that way I know that, hey, I can make that tackle and make it correctly because I may have to put some more effort into it, but I'm not worried about getting hurt. And part of that comes from the athletic trainer as well. The psychological part of having a taped ankle or having an ankle brace is super important. And also the honesty, having the honesty between a player and the coach and the athletic trainer, going in and knowing that you need to be honest with yourself before stepping on the field, because if the athletic trainer or the coach is pushing you to go out on the field and you maybe aren't feeling ready yet, that can lead to feeling and playing scared, and that's something that's not very good for the player or for the team.
A question from the audience now. I'm going to put this to John Stawinski first, but again, anyone can chime in on this if they like. Knowing that freak accidents can happen any time, how can athletes use cross-training to prevent injury or lessen the length of time an athlete spends on the sidelines once they're injured, strength training, et cetera, that kind of thing?
That's a great, great question. And that opens up a big can of worms in the area of over-specialization in sport and some of the other things that are going on. And to not get into that area and stay on task with this question, really developing a good foundation is critical not only to being durable as an athlete, but also to excelling as an athlete. There are there is generally a lack of cross-training, I feel. I think a lot of athletes think that the more they play, the better they're going to get, and to a degree that's correct. However, they will not be as durable. They will likely get some injuries that perhaps they could have avoided had they been stronger, had they had better mechanics, had they been able to use their bodies in a different way, had their bodies been more prepared for whatever activity that they're doing.
Can you give us a brief definition of cross-training for those
sure.
who may not be familiar with it?
Cross-training, dry land training, there's a couple words for it. But really what it is it's doing an activity that is totally not sport-specific in the sense that it has nothing to do with the soccer ball mm-hmm. or a baseball. But it is set up to develop the muscles, the motor patterns, the skills that you can then apply to your sport. So, a simple version of that might just be a simple weight room strength training program. That's something that's pretty common, pretty popular. A better thing would be a more functional program that involves whole body movements, strengthening through range of motion, developing more sport-specific strength, power, acceleration, things that are going to make you a better athlete. And so what I find is athletes that have not experienced that don't have that as part of a regular program. Maybe they have a season where they don't play their sport, but they do cross training, or maybe they have it built into their a whole annual program. Athletes that don't have that, I feel like they top out sooner. Maybe it's injury, repetitive injury. Maybe it's because they haven't developed the muscle, the power in their muscles to be able to go to the next level in their sport. So I think it's unfortunate, but I think there are a lot of athletes that don't realize their potential because they're so focused on specializing in one activity that they don't open their eyes and see what else they can do to build themselves up so that they can excel in that sport.
You know, we hear a lot about athletes when something's not going well on the field. I'm sure, Wendy, this has happened. They'll come to you and say, Coach, what can I do better? What am I doing wrong? That kind of thing. But, Sheila, I want to put this question to you. In the rehab process, when they're going through the hard road of getting back, that's the behind-the-scenes stuff. Nobody sees it. You don't have your teammates out there encouraging you. What do they ever open up to you and say, what can I do better? Am I doing anything wrong? Why am I not getting better? If it's not that 0 to 60 thing where they want to get back so fast.
Yep. You know, being in rehab is a very lonely place for an injured athlete, hence the pivotal relationship between the provider and the athlete. Goal setting, again, when an athlete gets hurt, what happens to their control? It gets taken away from them, okay? That is the biggest challenge for an athlete next to the athletic identity piece. They don't have control. The provider has the control. The doctor has the answers. They have to wait for the appointment. No athlete who excels likes that. So what I do in my field through the rehab process is really try to help them set goals, very tangible things, things that they can do, help them to communicate with the provider, give them as much control back as they had when they were an athlete, as much as I can give them. So they feel like they have authority over getting better. They have authority over their rehab. They can communicate with the doctor and say, I'm really feeling a little better. Might I be able to try this week? And the doctor's not going to shut the door and say no. See you in 2 weeks. An athletic trainer would never turn an injured athlete away. What they do is called bargaining in the cycle of being injured. They bargain with the medical provider, with themselves, to decide, can I do this? Can I do that? Give me something. Give me some carrot to hang above me that can motivate me, that would instill some confidence in me that I will get better, that the hope is there. So the longer the injury, ACLs, I have many, many ACLs in my private practice as well as at UVM. It's the greatest challenge to keep them involved, engaged, invested, and not get depressed and anxious and eating issues occur. So setting goals, giving them as much control back among and in the rehab process is very, very important.
And that could be up to a year-long injury in ACL, yeah. Right? Easily.
Yep. 9-10 months.
We have this question from the audience now, and I think I'll put it to Wendy Leeds. I would put it to Kelsey, but it's about her. So, is Kelsey a rarity because of her confident, smart attitude?
Well, not in Middlebury girl soccer. Kelsey is very special, yes.
There's a reason she's the captain of the squad.
Yep. Yeah. But I have to say, Middlebury kids are pretty amazing. I've been coaching in Middlebury for 22 years, and everything from middle school all the way up now to varsity. And I used to sort of take a deep breath and feel like, God, these kids are, if they would just play soccer year-round, then the program would be so much stronger. And they're just maddeningly well-rounded, these Middlebury kids, right? So, but I'm starting to kind of see the light in terms of what you were just saying a minute ago about, doing different things is good, is healthy. And the girls are amazing. They're pretty awesome.
Well, this, I have a follow-up to that because, Middlebury is such a renowned school for its academics, but also very competitive sports teams. And Aaron, maybe you can speak a little more to this. What are the demands of a student athlete like that perhaps other folks don't appreciate it? I'm not saying that people that don't play sports, are not as worthy or anything like that. But the student athlete is having to go through practices, through games, while maintaining high academic standards. What are those pressures like?
Yeah, I think there are several demands. Some of the demands aren't necessarily unique to athletes at a place like Middlebury College because the student body, it would be wrong to say student athletes are so involved and have all these things outside the classroom and the rest of the students are just in the library studying. It's a really active student body with a broad range of interests, extracurricular interests, personal interests, recreational sports. We were joking before, or not joking, but I think it was maybe a surprise that we've had the national champion log roller. We have national champion mountain bikers. So it's a really active student body, whether it's physical activity or not. So I don't think that's necessarily the differentiator at all. I think, some of the practical things like travel. If you're a student who's actively involved in most activities on campus, most of those activities take place on campus. If you play tennis, you might leave on a Friday afternoon and come back Sunday night at 11 o'clock at night after playing multiple hours of tennis over the weekend. And I just even think of my own athletic experience as long ago as it was, there's the physical demand that and you're not necessarily in control of that. You're just tired. You're not in control of how tired you are. If I'm not playing a sport and I want to go work out, I work out and I push myself as hard as I want. If I need to back off, I back off. If you're a part of a team, you sort of have whatever practice it is that day, and you don't necessarily control how much work you have that night. So there are those stresses. When they're done within reason and done with perspective and done within the context of what's important, what's most important at a place like Middlebury College, I think almost all of those stresses are positive. They teach all of the life lessons that are so positive around time management, around overcoming adversity, making choices, choosing whether I do that extra half hour workout or whether I do that extra half hour studying, all of those different choices that you're going to make for the rest of your life. Those choices don't stop when you graduate from college. Those happen and get harder and harder as you get older. So it's a great training ground in many ways. I've met with all our teams in the past. I'm trying to get through all of our teams. And I just find myself over and over again saying, you've got this really safe, wonderful laboratory of Division III athletics. If you're thinking of it that way, we're not here just to play the games. That's the object of what we're doing. The purpose is much more about preparing for life. So we're in the right context to be able to talk about those things at a place like Middlebury.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think adding on to what Mr. Quinn just said, if you talk to most student athletes, they will tell you that they're probably the most efficient and they manage their time the best in season, as backwards as that may seem. Going to practice for me, coming straight out of school, going to a two-hour practice, I don't really have a choice but to do my homework when I get home. I don't have like 8 hours, 9 hours to get it done when I get out of school. And so I think that that allows my grades to do pretty well, especially during during season. And that time management skill that Mr. Quinn was talking about is incredibly important. And for me, I've played club soccer since I was 11. And if anyone knows anything about club soccer, the closest place is either Burlington or Rutland. And so I travel to Burlington 3 times a week, pretty much all year round. So that's an hour there, an hour and a half practice, and an hour back. And that starting when I was 10, 11 years old. And that may be a little extreme for people in our area, but people who play up in Burlington and Rutland, they have the same sort of schedule. And that time management, being able to figure out, okay, I get home, I have an hour to get my homework done, and I'm then headed up to practice and I'm coming back. The ability to go and talk to teachers and say, you know, I have a game, I have a practice, and can we figure something out to how I can get this done and get it into you on time? And teachers are really good about that, but you have to make sure that you communicate.
Got some more audience questions here, and this is touches on something I think Kelsey was just talking about there at the end. Do you believe there is adequate staffing, coaches and trainers, to safely operate youth sports as young as third grade? That's 9 or 10 year olds, you know, and I'm going to age myself here. I don't remember sports being so organized when I was that age. I mean, we would go out and play street hockey until it got dark and then come home. It just seems everything is much more organized and regimented now. But is there enough staffing, coaches and trainers, for kids that young across the general society? I'm just kind of throwing this one out there, whoever wants to tackle that first.
Depends on who you ask.
Because
I will tell you that even at the top level of collegiate athletics, they always claim they don't have enough resources. So the Ohio States of the world, the UCLAs of the world, the Alabamas of the world. If you talk to their medical staff, they don't have enough. you know, if you talk to the people that are paying the bills, they have plenty. So I think it's very community dependent, to be honest with you, and school dependent. I think I know at Castleton, we probably could use, you know, 1 to 2 more athletic trainers. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. But is it a big monetary challenge? Yep. It's a big monetary resource challenge. So you're balancing, you know, there's the ideal and then there's sort of the minimum, and you're always trying to play between the two.
Do kids need all that? I mean, do they need all that formal staffing, coaching?
Well, I think, you know, again, I think it depends on the level. Yeah. The level in the community. And I think if you have a program that has collision sports, then yeah, you probably need some, you know, a higher level of sort of overall care. If you're sort of running like my girls play Saturday morning soccer down in Rutland, and 6 and 4 year olds, yeah, we probably don't need, you know, that much. It's not, you know, there's not a lot to it. So
I got a really, really interesting question here. Referees play a vital role in keeping kids safe. Sometimes in youth hockey, it seems, and in youth soccer, they let kids get away with too much and more injuries happen. How can we support referees in calling tighter games? And there's a ref here in the audience, by the way, who's excellent, apparently.
I'll speak to that one a little bit. First of all, become a referee. The issue with referees is there's so few, and they're
So if at a youth level you're able to find an official to officiate who's actually trained and patched, that's great. I know in the Middlebury area it's very difficult to find officials. I struggle even with, you know, covering JV soccer games. Last year, I'd say 50% of our JV soccer games were covered by one official. I think most officials would argue that a three-person crew is a much better crew. And in the state of Vermont, we've talked about that, and some schools are using three-person crews for the varsity games. But the hard part about that is there's not enough officials then to cover other schools' games.
Why is it so hard to find them? And I'm wondering, is it because it's often a thankless job and they take a lot of abuse?
Absolutely. It's one of the part of my speeches I give to my parents is, you know, the hardest part of my job is replacing coaches. And the other hard part is finding officials. Mm-hmm. And coaches and officials get out of the business for the same reason. It's because of the abuse, the parent involvement, the and also just having the time to do it and the sacrifice that they have to do. Give their, you know, their family, they're leaving their family to travel all over the state. I'm talking officials now. You know, it's a lot to ask. We had a field hockey game on Wednesday after the torrential downpours and freezing cold rain. The closest official we got was from Brattleboro. We've had officials come from New Hampshire. There's not the numbers. And I say this about my coaches, it's having somebody who's either self-employed, works in education, has an outstanding boss, or is independently wealthy. Those are the people who can fit the mold and become an official or become a coach. And that number is certainly shrinking every year. And our officials that we have now are getting to the age that they're not necessarily going to be able to sustain, and we need newer, younger officials to get involved. And so due to attrition, we just don't have with the question about do we have enough people down there, we don't. We need more. And, you know, the same thing with coaching. I can place an ad in the paper for a coaching position and get one, two people apply.
Wendy, how do you feel about the refs generally? You're a coach. Coaches sometimes aren't real crazy about the refs.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because the balance is you want to let the kids play, but your job is also to keep them safe out there. And a good ref will know when to see that play is equal and it's, you know, when people are safe, it's maybe a physical contest. But when people start to take it a little too far, they got to rein them in quickly and keep control over the game. I think that, you know, one of the things that's hard is when refs make inconsistent calls, because then it's confusing for the players who are, you know, all at different levels of learning in terms of where they are in their soccer knowledge, in their soccer IQ. And so that, you know, that becomes tricky. But, you know, for the most part, I really believe that they're doing the best they can. And if you approach them with questions in a respectful way, you usually get pretty good answers. Or every once in a while, like today, he'll say, I think I might have gotten that one wrong. You know, oh well, you know, I'm not perfect either. But we need more refs. We also need more coaches, and we need more female coaches, and we need more female refs. I think, well, you know, so I coach girls soccer, so I don't know if there are a lot of females out there coaching boys soccer, but there's one other female coach, I believe, in our schedule, our regular season schedule that we see. So that's...
Why do you feel it would be important, though, to have more female referees?
More female referees?
Yeah, and coaches.
Just we're underrepresented, you know? Girls are out there on the field, and I think we need to be out there, too. You know, they need to see that. I mean, my unique bias, I suppose, is that I think, you know, soccer for me is a lifetime sport. It's something that you can play your whole life, and so... And I hope, you know, the vast majority of the girls that I coach are not going to go on to play after high school. And hopefully they love it and it becomes a lifestyle and they join and play pickup and they love that so much that they, you know, as they get older, they decide they want to stay involved in the game, and coaching and reffing is a great way to do that.
I would say, so I'm a dog dad of girls, right? Dogs club. We have a dogs club in my office because we all have girls, but... Mm-hmm. I would like nothing more than my two daughters to grow up with positive female role models as coaches, or officials, and just I think it's there's only so much. I mean, there's certainly stuff that I can give them, but there's stuff I can't, you know, as their dad. So I think it would be tremendous.
Dr. Gammons, we have to stick with you for a minute, and I'm not surprised that this has occurred. There was a question from an audience member saying that they're baffled that you're minimizing, in their words, research on CTE. Recent, I'm going to struggle with reading some of the handwriting here, but recent post-mortem study of NFL players, 87 out of 94 CTE football practice and games involve repetitive impacts. Not only head impacts, every collision shakes the brain. We have no biological markers and depend on imperfect clinical diagnosis, but evidence of cumulative damage, multiple hits, show that parents have to give informed consent on this issue. So,
well, again, I think we have week-long conferences on this alone, breaking down the research. And one of the problems, of course, with CTE is that it's basically a post-mortem diagnosis. The current issues with what's going on at BU is they have no control group, so they basically have people that have had issues that have donated brains. Now, it may be that over the next 20 years that we get more and more brains. The best markers that we do have, and there's been a couple of studies on former players that using functional MRI and other things, and there's been no direct correlation between what they assume is CTE changes and the behavioral and other changes. So we're getting very mixed messages about. I don't want to say that CTE is not real, because I think it is for some people. I think some people's brains don't like. I mean, nobody would argue it's bad. You know, it's good to hit your head too much. But at what level does it tip somebody over? What are the factors, and what are the true risk factors, or things that we don't know or understand? Why most people who have played football over the last 100 years plus, you know, have not sort of fallen into this category? Some of it's recognition, but there have been studies that have looked at it, and football players in the 50s and 60s and 70s were. Theoretically, helmet technology wasn't as good, but I think that it's a bigger question mark than the media wants to sort of delve into or can delve into, because there's not a lot of again, good evidence. And I know the BU people, and I don't think they're intentionally trying to mislead anybody, but even they will admit that we're at the very tip of trying to understand this, and that it's not everybody who's going to have this problem. Now, on the other hand, I don't think there's any question that if you play high school football and college football and you play in the NFL, that there's probably some increased risk. I mean, I don't think there's any question. But what risk is that? That we don't know, and it's impossible to define. And so, like I said, I go back to, you know, it's exposure. I go back to, you know, how much good are kids getting out of playing football? I think there's been a lot of positive changes in terms of just taking out unnecessary impact. I would argue that, yes, the brain shakes even without direct head impact, but you can't even look at the force data, because the force data is so poor and doesn't correlate well with what we see at the brain level. So the HITS, what's called HITS technology, it's what they put in the helmets where they measure. It doesn't model well, and so you really have a surrogate. You have the surrogate on the outside, and we're not measuring well on the inside. And so there's just way more questions than answers. So I guess my point was not to minimize it, but there's a balance between saying, is my son who just had a concussion going to get CTE, and whether or not there's somebody who plays football long enough or boxes long enough or does something long enough, are they going to get it? And I think, you know, that's a big gap in between those two things.
Yes, go ahead, Aaron.
I think following up a doctor on that question is probably a big mistake. But so we were contacted several years ago by a doctor from the Boston Children's Hospital who wanted to do a retrospective study of NESCAC athletes because the exposures that NESCAC athletes are exposed to are less than, say, a football player who made it to the NFL, which might mean that he played Texas 5A football and, you know, played 9 months a year against bigger bodies, and then he might have played at a big college where they go to camp in early August and they have 12 games and they have postseason and then they have spring football. So might it be different at NESCAC? And there's it's a retrospective study, it's survey-based, it's NIH-validated, and it's published in the Journal of Neuroscience in 2015. And that study would say that on quality of life measures, that NESCAC athletes who play collision sports do not have a diminished quality of life relative to those who do not play sports. So it's not measuring, you know, the brain in the moment of impact or right after. It's not that. It's saying over the quality of your, over the span of your life, are your quality of life measures the same? And the answer in that study was yes. And because there's limited studies we can do and we're most interested in what happens to our athletes, that was, you know, I think affirming in the moment. And we keep reassessing information as it becomes available to us, but that's available to us, and we thought it was an important information.
At the very least, I think it's fair to say that just listening to the symptoms that Kelsey was talking about before with her concussions, it's pretty serious. You know, what you suffer after a concussion, you don't want to be thrown out back on the field too soon. I mean, are there enough protections protocol in the state of Vermont, for example, after Act 68 was passed in 2013, that give guidelines for when a player should get back on the field after a concussion?
As part of the group that was, we basically worked on that law. You know, I think the answer is maybe, but again, there goes to the gap. I think the, you know, there are some people's brains that tolerate concussions better than other people's brains. There are some, you know, for example, and again, you can only use yourself, and I don't think an N-of-1 is the best, but one of the concussions I had at UVM, I got kicked in the head at practice on Thursday night. I don't remember 24 hours. I finished the practice. My roommates kindly took me to a frat party that night that I don't remember. But I took 3 engineering tests that next morning and got all A's on. And so, but I don't remember anything up, you know, I don't remember anything from Thursday afternoon until I woke up Friday morning. So what's different about that than Kelsey and somebody who has these prolonged symptoms? So I just think it's not, again, there's so little we know. Each injury is not the same. Each individual is not the same. That we put in a protocol that's as safe as we have made, you know, we think we can make it based on the best science that we currently have, knowing that that science is pretty bad to begin with.
Maybe a follow-up to that, and I'll put this one to John Stawinski, audience question. Please comment on the importance of rest for good athletic performance and social, psychological, emotional health. Perhaps, Sheila, you can answer that as well, during the season, between sports seasons, and during games even.
Well, when you talk about rest in an athlete, really one thing that comes to mind is the phrase overtraining. So I think it's extremely important as an athlete not to get in the state of being overtrained. Now, now that said, with adequate rest, nutrition, good conditioning program, something that has a good scientific basis, education and awareness about that, I think that it's minimal. I think it's pretty difficult to overtrain in most sports. Now, when you're talking about a student athlete, you have the academic piece, and then, of course, especially at that age, you have the social piece. And those are all important pieces. The social piece is just as important as anything else. You don't want to isolate a person and have them just go from class to the field and then to bed, you know, in an effort to keep them from being overtrained. So, so I think that you have to look at the big picture. You have to balance. That's a big word these days. You have to balance all those things, and just have to make sure that you are taking care of yourself in all those areas. And don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to check in with your coach, check in with your athletic trainer, check in with your parents, and just make sure that your perception of what's going on is accurate.
Another question from the audience, and I want to have both Sheila and Wendy deal with this one. How do you deal with an athlete who is not being truthful about how he or she really feels?
Mm-hmm. I was just about to say that, yeah, just on the heels of what you were just saying, John, that, you know, creating that culture of honesty in that, and creating that trusting relationship between, you know, for me, with my players, is obviously hugely important for a million reasons, and that's just one of them. But also, you know, creating that culture of buy-in and really getting the kids to buy into this idea of, like, it matters. It's really important to report honestly. And we struggled with that a little bit at Middlebury when we first implemented the protocol and kind of
became more educated and aware around concussions, and I think that there wasn't there were definitely times when symptoms were not being reported honestly because kids wanted to play, and gradually that started to shift, and I feel like there's pretty good buy-in now from the kids, and they, you know, certainly having players who are in positions of leadership, modeling that is super important and really helpful in terms of contributing to that culture that we're trying to build around that.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, do you see that?
I do, and prior to the protocol, and John and I working together for so long, I think that was one of the issues, kids under-reporting symptoms, right? You know, when did the headache go away? Oh, 3 days ago, maybe it was yesterday, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think the protocol really ensures that despite what they say, they have to wait that time period, even if they feel great. So that's important, and I think a lot of that is mitigated by just educating. And I think fears come around the fact that it's our brain. You know, knee's going to heal. Is the brain going to heal? You need the brain the rest of your life. Knees you can do other things with and replace it when you're 70. You know, brains don't really rebound necessarily. So the education piece is vital in mitigating the worries, the fears, and also, again, trusting your providers, trusting the system, the educational system, that these are in place for your safety. And losing a little bit of time is okay. You know.
Sean, you wanted to follow up?
Yeah, I think another big part of that is, you know, and I keep going back to relationships, is understanding and knowing your athletes. And it's teachers reporting back to the athletic department, you know, hey, I had so-and-so in the class. They don't look good. Things, they're not acting the same way. Was there something that happened in the game this week? Having a full-time certified athletic trainer who's in-house, who knows our athletes, to me, that now that we have one, I couldn't live without one. She's wonderful, and she understands these kids. She has a relationship with the students, and she can tell if they're off. Mm-hmm. And to have that kind of takes that guessing game away, or the opportunity for the kids to fake it, and, you know, so they can get back on the field. 9 out of 10 times, you know, she'll catch it and say, I don't know, that's not happening.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, you wanted to follow up.
Adding on to that, I think that 10th time that maybe she doesn't catch it, there's people that around them, their friends and their teammates, their captains, can also see that, but they need to know to report it. I had this past year, we had someone who suffered from a head injury, and I heard a different story than the athletic trainer heard about something that had happened in a class. And I made the executive decision that I needed to go talk to the athletic trainer and just say, hey, this is what I heard. I didn't say anything about diagnosis or anything because that's not my place, and I don't know anything on that front. But I wanted to make sure that my player was sound and healthy before stepping on the field. And the discrepancy in stories was something that I wasn't necessarily comfortable with. And so I think that also comes with the C or the captain position, and knowing that as a captain, you may have to make that call about, hey, we just need to make sure that the honesty is a really big part of it. Just making sure that the coaches and the athletic trainers know that their players are being honest. And I experienced that back in April, 2 Aprils ago, when I had my concussion. I unfortunately was not probably pretty honest in the first 2 weeks that I had it, and that set me back pretty far. And whether I like to admit it or not, I think that being upfront and being able to accept your fate, if you may call it, and being able to sit down with the athletic trainer and say, okay, we're looking at 3 weeks. That may not be the best thing that you wanted to hear or what you were looking for, but at that point you have time to accept it and sort of move on from that with the support of people around you, but you need to make sure that you're being honest.
It's so interesting that you say that that's part of what the C, that captain, is all about. Wendy, would you agree that that's something you don't give out lightly to a player, that you're going to want someone like Kelsey who's going to be able to make that call and maybe even get some resentment from that player saying, you know, why are you interfering here? Why did you go to the athletic director?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, they're kind of my eyes and ears. I can't be everywhere all the time and see and hear everything all the time, and I really rely on them to make sure that, you know, that I have the whole picture.
Got another audience question here. Again, I'm sorry, I'm struggling a little bit with the handwriting, but mine is way worse, so I think I can get through this. The premise of college sports is that team victory is more important than whatever happens to individual participants. Imagine that everyone on the panel will object, but perhaps there should be someone on the panel who is permanently disabled as a result of trying to disprove this assertion. I think I'm getting that right. I hope I got that question right for whoever asked it there. And I think the point being that you know, there isn't anyone here who has been permanently disabled as a result of a sports injury, and easy for us to say, I suppose, that, you know, hey, we all get hurt, that kind of thing. Tough question. Anyone want to
talk about that? I'm in college sports, so I can take the first stab at it. I think, first of all, because I am in college sports, I would challenge the very strongly the assertion that college sports at the level where I operate anyway is about the team winning. I think it's about the team philosophically over the individual, but not about the team winning. Again, we talk all the time about the object of a particular sporting event. The object is to win. That's sort of what you organize around. That's the object. But the purpose of what we do is much bigger, and it's around preparing you for life, preparing you to be the best person you can be, the best citizen you can be. So putting yourself at risk unnecessarily, putting your teammate at risk unnecessarily, putting your player, if you're the coach or the administrator, it does not mesh with that at all. And I think, you know, I was struck when Kelsey was talking of thinking about the major culture shift, and it's probably been a couple of culture shifts over time. When I played, and maybe people my age or older, we just didn't talk about concussions. It's not that you hid them or whatever, or you might laugh about it. Somebody's kind of loopy or whatever. You just really didn't talk about it. It was not part of the narrative. Then I think there was probably the first awareness of concussions. Then I think there was a big culture around hiding it, coaches questioning, you know, do you really have a concussion? Do you not have a concussion? I don't know what the year is on that. But it was first when concussion awareness, hey, when I played, we didn't have to worry about this. You must be faking it, or you're not that tough. And I think we're well beyond that. We're well beyond putting people at risk. And I truly think, I'm saying at the high school for sure, youth sports, and definitely at the college level where I am, the culture is absolutely a safety first culture. The concern students would be telling a coach or a trainer about somebody's injury that they were concerned with. And the other way I would answer it really quickly, and it's not firsthand, so I won't go into much depth, is I have heard several Middlebury College athletes who are permanently disabled talk about their athletic experience and not wanting to give it back. And while as challenging as it is, it's made them who they are, and they've adjusted, and their athletic experience prepared them for that. They wouldn't wish it on anybody, but they're able to adjust, and they would not change what they've done. So I think the two people I'm thinking of in particular would sit up here and absolutely defend their experience for sure.
And I think that's, if you look, and you can speak this well, but if you look across the bulk of the research that's been done on athletes with both, you know, moderately severe or severe injuries, by a huge amount, the athletes always say that. I certainly am not happy that I'm hurt, but I wouldn't trade the experience. And I happen to know Kevin Pierce pretty well. Some of you guys may know Kevin, who's from Vermont, or snowboard, didn't have a concussion, had a traumatic brain injury, bad traumatic brain injury. But even Kevin's with it enough now, and I see him in the winter competitions, and, you know, he wouldn't have traded anything that he did. Of course, he's not happy that he got hurt, but he wouldn't have traded anything for it. And I think universally across the board, that's the way it is. Now, are there individuals? You know, certainly. I mean, it's, you know, it's not 100% in anything, but I think that just goes to the value of athletics. And, yeah, we should be as safe as we can be. And the new chief medical officer for the NCAA, they just hired one, actually, last year, really, for the first time, a guy named Brian Haline, who I know quite well. He's instituting all sorts of new policies to try to make it safer. As safe as we can, you know. And I think when you talk about this, we really can't – I hate the word injury prevention, because you just can't prevent all injuries. What we're really trying to do is put risk reduction. We're trying to reduce the risk that something might happen. But then you're not going to prevent – all the injuries from happening. And, you know, to what degree you do that? Do you not play football at all, or do you change, you know, I mean, again, it's all, you know, everything has a consequence in terms of what rules you change. And if you look, there was a very famous study in Sweden when they went from no helmets to requiring helmets, and the amount of teeth loss and lacerations went down, but the amount of concussions went up because they were wearing helmets. So people didn't, you know, so there's this balance where every time we sort of institute anything, whether it be behavioral change or rule change, that it's not all just one-sided. And so we constantly sort of grapple with decisions as a medical team and as a college team, you know, the athletic directors and the coaches is, okay, where do we fit that in to try to keep people as safe as we can, but allow them to get all the benefits of the sports that they want to play and are passionate about.
We've been up here for a while, folks. You've all been absolutely wonderful. I'm going to give the last word of the night, though, to Kelsey, our youngest participant tonight, who, again, was gracious to come here tonight after a game. I think that's fantastic. Kelsey, I just wonder what playing soccer at Middlebury has meant to you, and, you know, how would you ever trade it, even for risk of a serious injury?
Absolutely not. I think especially at Middlebury, in my experience with the team, and Wendy in particular has been one of absolute class and one of absolute fun. I think I go to practice and we have games and they are my family. I see them every day after school. I see them on the weekends and I see them late at night on bus rides home from Missisquoi and 2 miles from the Canadian border. And it's absolutely wonderful. And yes, there are stresses to it and nobody wants to get injured. But the skills that I've learned from playing soccer, the time management, the cooperation, the teamwork, everything is so incredibly important, and I valued it so much. And I would not trade it for anything, and especially not at Middlebury.
Audience members who showed up tonight, you folks were wonderful. Your questions were fantastic. You really added so much to this discussion tonight. I especially want to thank our panelists again, Aaron Quinn, Sean Farrell, Wendy Leeds, Dr. Matt Gammons, John and Sheila Stawinski, and again, the Town Hall Theater for letting us come here tonight for this really wonderful discussion. Thank you all so very much. Really appreciate it.